Good morning, church family. If you've had, you guys are awake. That's so great. We even got clapping going for a minute or two. That was exciting. Yeah, I thought you guys might be a little tired at the beginning of the year. Well, it's good to see you all this morning. My name is Eric, and I have the pleasure of preaching the word this morning. So glad to see you all. If you've had the chance to come over to my house before, you might have seen this hanging over the threshold of our door. And it is a verse that is from the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the beginning of the third chapter, and it certainly sits there as a bit of a warning. It's a little bit ominous as you're tying a shoe or you're crossing the threshold of the door. It's sitting there, and it doesn't really leave you with a lot of explanation, does it? Right? It's just kind of a statement. It lacks the explanation of the rest of the book. I suppose if I was to put the entire book of Ecclesiastes up on the wall, the font would get really small, wouldn't be very practical. But it leaves you with some questions, certainly. It's a bit ominous, but it is, at minimum, a little bit of a warning, is it not, that change may be ahead. There may be some change coming, and just be aware of that as you cross through the door. Ecclesiastes 3 certainly gives us more than just a warning of that. It actually gives us some very interesting observations about time and the nature of time, and it also gives us some really helpful insights on things to do. The text that's above the doorway, it doesn't detail out what you're supposed to do, but the text in front of us in the Bible certainly does. And so I think as we cross over the threshold into a new year and we think about the things that are in front of us, as we think about the passing of another year, it would be helpful to return back to this text. Now, some of you, very astute, might be like, hey, we went through this text. You know, that was almost 6 years ago. You can believe that? Yeah, I think I heard someone say, what? It's been a while since we've been in this book. If you've been here at the church for a while, we went through some of the summertime. But I think it would be helpful to return back to the text, see some of the observations of Solomon, consider some of the things that he has to say to us, and really answer the question of what should we do with another year? What should we do with it, right? This text, when we study the whole thing, calls us to action, to do things. And so to do that, we're going to need to step back into the book of Ecclesiastes. And for some of us, we spent some time there. But for the rest of us, we probably all need a refresher. So if you've got a Bible or there's a Bible in front of you on the chair rack in front of you, I'd encourage you to open it up to the book of Ecclesiastes. It is located on page 477 in the Old Testament. On that chair rack Bible, it's right next to the book of Proverbs. We're going to be in the book pretty much the whole time this morning. So it'd be helpful for you to have it in front of you if you don't. I'm going to give you just a second to get there. I'm just kind of recapping some of the things that the author of this book has said and some of the things that he's doing. I think it would be helpful to remind yourself of that. So in chapter 1, verse 12 to 14, he sets out really, and I'll be reading from the ESV this morning, he sets out some of the things that he's to do in this book. Chapter 1, verse 12 reads, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with, and I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. And so that's how he lays out the beginning of this book, and if you're familiar with it, you'll know that in the second chapter, he begins to go try things. He's looking for purpose. He's looking for meaning, and he's like, well, I'll try this, see if this works. I'll try this. And he goes through, and he first starts off trying pleasure. He's like, maybe pleasure can make me happy. Maybe it can satisfy me. And then he turns to the idea of wisdom and knowledge, flipping through chapter 2. And then he concludes with the idea of work or toil. And he's searching, and the search hasn't been going very well, if you're familiar with the book. Things certainly have little glimmers of hope, but he's looking for something that can bear the weight of satisfying him in the deepest way, and it hasn't been going well. And that gets us to chapter 3, where he then considers, what about the passage of time? Perhaps in the passage of time, there will be something there that will satisfy me. And so that's where we find our text this morning. And we'll see some observations that he has at the beginning, and then we'll see two things that he commends us to. So you hopefully already have the text in front of you. You can stay seated. I'm going to read verses 1 through 8 of chapter 3. It says, for everything there is a season. There is a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time for love, a time for hate, a time for war and a time for peace. And so here we have Solomon beginning his observations. And so we need to, you know, even though verses 2-8 are very beautiful and interesting, we need to stop and look at verse number 1. And he makes some observations. The first thing in verse 1, very beginning of it, the thing that's hanging over my door, is the observation that there seems to be some seasonality to life. There seems to, just like the weather is changing around us, there seems to be some flow. There's something about what's happening in the progressions, and you heard them in verses 2-8. There's a time to be born, a time to live, a time to die. There's getting, there's using, there's disposing. There's these flows of things that he's observing, and he's making note of them, and he's saying, hey, there's something to that. The rest of verse 1 seems like it might just be needless repetition. You're like, is he just saying the same thing over again? And I don't think that's entirely what's happening here. He's trying to highlight that there are appropriate times. There's times where it's like, oh, well, that's kind of the right spot, a correct time for things to happen. He's observing that he's not trying to tell you, like, hey, have good timing. I don't think it's that. It's just an observation that there are times where it's like, oh, well, that kind of makes sense. That seems right. And so he's picking up on there's kind of a rhythmic flow to things. Like there's a movement, and you're like, okay, I can see some rhyme and some reason to this. And I suppose for some of you, you're listening, and perhaps you might find fault with what I've just said, or even that the preacher has said. You might, experientially, you might say, well, hold on, the world actually seems very chaotic, and there seem to not be patterns. And if that's you, I just want to say, hold on to that thought. We'll get there in verse 11. Just be patient. It's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is that just because we can't notice the pattern right now doesn't mean it's not there. And so I would just gently encourage you that it is there. He's making the correct observation, but there may be times where we can't see it. And so let's consider his evidence. He gives us evidence in verse 2-8. That there are these patterns, these seasons. There are these correct times. So we're just going to step through the verses and consider this poem where he describes everything. And so he starts off in Genesis chapter 1 and 3 with these ideas of birth and death. Right? You know, he at the very outset, he's established he's not trying to consider trivial matters. He's trying to consider the weighty things of life. He's examining the command of the creation mandate in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, to be fruitful and multiply, birth, new life. And then he's also being very realistic. He's including in it Genesis 3:19, to dust you shall return. This is he's trying to give us an accurate picture. And let's consider just for a moment, what is he trying to do in these verses? They're very interesting. They sound interesting to the ear, right? He's giving us contrasting pairs, things that are polar opposites to each other. And I think even in the English, like, it sounds interesting. It's engaging. But beyond that, I think he's trying to paint the things between those two extremes. He's trying to give us a picture of what life is like. And I think he's doing that to imply all those things between. He's trying to capture in word and art what it is, the human existence. Whatever this thing is, he's trying to draw out these important points of interest to give you information about what he sees. And he certainly does a great job at it. Let's continue on. The second half of verse 2 says there's a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Now for us, it's been a few years since this is written. We're thinking planting like gardening. But you got to remember, this is 3,000 years ago, and a lot of people lived and died by crops. Crops were life. Many of the festivals and things in the Old Testament times were geared around the agrarian cycle. And so this would be appropriate for him to start with this idea. This makes sense. This was on a lot of people's minds. The activity of toiling the ground and getting it ready to plant, and then harvesting what has been planted. It again mirrors this life and death idea that runs through verse 2. Continuing on to verse 3, it says a time to kill or a time to heal. This is interesting too, because it's not really clear what it's about. Is it talking about people? Is it talking about livestock? It's not really specified. And the word kill here, it's even included in the way that Cain and Abel are that story plays out, this word is used as well. So it could potentially even include the idea of murder. It is something where the healing might possibly have to do with being healed from some sort of disease or something like that, but it could also be agrarian too. Like, it could just be a reference to, hey, there's a time to feed that animal, and then there's a time to be like, tonight, your dinner. There is just that reality here where he's trying to paint a picture of what it is to have life and be life. Verse 3 continues, right? A time to break down, a time to build up. Construction has certainly been an enduring reality all throughout life. There's a time to be like, this is no longer useful for me. Tear it down and let's restart. That's certainly a pattern in life. Verse 4, we move into the idea of human emotions, right? The ideas of what it is to be human, weeping and laughing. Said another way, there's a time to be happy and there's a time to be sad. I think that's very helpful to see that the spectrum of human emotions that he's capturing here. He continues on with the idea of there's a time to mourn and there's a time to dance, right? Like, we rightfully mourn at the passing of someone or a tragic event, but we dance, we celebrate when, there's a wedding or something to celebrate. And for the Baptists in the room, there's some interesting notes here. In the original Hebrew, dance can also be translated to potluck or to casserole. Sorry. On the heels of laughing, I had to do it. I was laughing about that for, like, Melissa had to endure it. It doesn't mean that. I hope you don't take me seriously. There's a time to have emotion, right? Like, we're not designed to just be flat. Like, that's life. It's helpful to see that. Verse 5 continues on. And it says, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. Like, what does that mean? The reality is it's been 3,000 years since this has been written. There might be meaning here that's just kind of been lost to us. If you have a study Bible, it probably footnotes the idea of you take stones out of the ground to plant. And if you want to sabotage somebody's field, you throw a bunch of stones in it. Perhaps, I think that's the right sense of it. Perhaps to illustrate that, let's just talk about my house for a moment. Around my house are these beautiful little rocks, little tiny rocks. Can you imagine them all around the house? There's one problem. I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they're both boys. And so rocks are projectiles and toys, are they not? And so the rule in our house is rocks with rocks. Like, we keep the rocks with the rocks. But invariably, the rocks end up in the grass, which is a problem, right? It sinks down into the clay, you step on the clay, and now the grass can't grow. There's the picture, right? There's a blocking of life that happens there. The second half of verse 5 seems to not be related, and there's two verses like this that seem to not connect. It says a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. This carries with it the idea of hugs. It also carries with it other ideas that I won't mention, but the concept is fairly simple, right? Like, there's a time to greet somebody with a hug. Maybe don't do it while they're taking a driver's test, though, right? Like, there's a time and a place for these things. Verse 6 continues, and it talks about our stuff. And again, he's just trying to observe these seasons, these different things that happen. It talks about our stuff, right? There's a time and a place to seek out the thing you lost. The back half of the first phrase, to lose, has the idea of saying, well, I lost it, I can't find it. There's a time and a place to give up on the search for a lost thing. Continuing in the verse, there's a time to keep. There's a time to cast away, right? There's a time to hold on to what you have. There's a time and a place to just list it on Facebook Marketplace and just be like, I'm done with it. It's just the reality of life and our stuff. Continue on, verse 7, we're talking about our clothes. Again, we need to remind ourselves, fast fashion, didn't exist, right? People had very few clothing, pieces of clothing. Like what you had, you would tear it symbolically, but you would maintain that piece of clothing because you probably didn't have much, if even just one article of clothing. This was a reality to keep and to fix your clothing, verse 7. Continuing again in verse 7, the back half seems to not match. And there's a time to be quiet, and there's a time to say something. And I think we all need to hear that. And you're all like, yeah, that person over there. But then you're like, no, this person right here, right? We all need to hear this one. There's a time and a place to say something. And then we get to verse 8. Verse 8. Was it the birds that made it famous? Turn, turn, turn. I know some of you have been singing it this whole time. I know you have. But they made it famous by tacking onto the end of this verse, I swear it's not too late, and my thoughts about that aside. This verse is enduringly interesting. It's engaging because it's a problem that has persisted for the past 3,000 years. It just continues to be an issue, right? The emotions of love and hate, but certainly war and peace. And if you think for a moment about the person who wrote this, he would have actually had an interesting perspective, wouldn't he? Like, Solomon was sitting at the high water mark of the Jewish kingdom, and he saw all of his father David, all of the wars of his father. He would have had a very interesting perspective. I'm sure it would have been interesting to have heard his thoughts on all of this. I think it's very interesting to consider all the ideas in verse 2 through 8, but it does really leave us with kind of a so what, right? A so what? Because if he's trying to make moral judgments about things, he's doing a very weak job at it. There are things in here that seem to be wrong, and yet he's describing them. It doesn't seem that he's really giving us much of his thoughts on the matter just yet. And I think we need to ask why, and it's really just because he's trying to record what he sees. And he does a really beautiful job. Like, if we just look back at the text, there's a reason why this is one of the most famous sections of this book. So it speaks well to the moment as we see it. Sure, we need to do some translation to think, okay, what does it look like in our current moment? But it carries over, and it describes life as we know it. And what's interesting, and we're going to draw out different principles from verse 9 to 15, the first thing that comes to be observed here is he does draw some conclusions about this. And so I think we would be wrong if we didn't draw this out now. And that observation is in verse 11. And his conclusion about all of this is that it's beautifully appropriate. I'll give you a moment if you're taking notes. Look at verse 11 with me. We'll consider the rest of the text here in just a moment, but I think it's helpful to observe one thing that he highlights. He says, he has made everything beautiful in its time. So he looks at all of this, he observes it, and he says there's something fitting and appropriate about it. And that's interesting. I think we would do well to think about the word that he uses in verse 11, because it's interesting. The ESV gives it's beautiful in its time, which is helpful. The NASB says appropriate in its time, and I'll make one person excited by citing the NET, the slightly more obscure translation here, but the NET actually does a great job of capturing the sense of it. It says it's fit beautifully in its appropriate time. Like, it's fit beautifully in its appropriate time. Like, there's something about the timing that's right and correct, and you're like, that's exactly what I would expect it to be. That's exactly what I would want it to be. Perhaps a music illustration will be helpful here. Just imagine yourself for a moment, you're sitting there, you're listening to someone play a song. You're listening to someone perform music live, and it's a song you love. You know this song. And they play the next note, and it's exactly what you expected, it's exactly when you expected it, and you're like, I am enjoying listening to this person play this song. This is great. Sorry, jazz people, I know I offended some people, but right, like, when you consider like the flow of it, you're like, that's exactly what I expected, it's exactly what I wanted. And that's the picture here in verse 11. I think we need to take a moment and realize, looking at verse 2 through 8, Solomon's not ignorant to the pain and the bad things, right? Look back at that list. There's some objectively bad and undesirable things. He's not ignorant to that. But he's capturing all of the things he knows, the brokenness of the world, the sinfulness of man. He's capturing even God. We'll go there in verse 14 and 15. He's capturing all the things he sees, and he's going, yep, that's about what I would expect. That's right. Like, that makes sense. And I want to stretch you for just a moment and say that you can actually see the beautiful appropriateness in life and all the different moments in life. I want you to think for a moment. It's easy to see it in the objectively good stuff, right? The moments where you're busy and you find a great parking spot at the store you're trying to shop at. Or maybe let's move out of the trivial and go into more serious things where, like, you've been looking for a new job for a long time and you finally found it. And there's something, you're like, oh, this is right, this is good. The reality, though, is I want to stretch you to realize that even the bad and painful stuff is included, too. And so perhaps just to paint that with more realism, like from my own life, a couple months ago, like one of my employees, about my age, just like suddenly passed away. It was like right before busy season. Just like, God, not there. Like, just not right now, right? But through that, God provided strength. God provided the means to do what was necessary. God provided lessons that I probably wouldn't have learned any other way. Like, God provided me reminders of the urgency of the gospel. Like, God provided me the reminder to hug my kids, to enjoy the days that I have. Right? Like, there's something beautifully appropriate about every single moment we find ourselves in. It's not just the good and happy stuff. And I want to stretch you to see that. And the reality is, like, look over there, right? Like, 10 years ago, we were talking about, like, a three-story building with, like, all kinds of other things, and we had a lot of trials and obstacles corporately as a group, but God has provided exactly what we need. And perhaps this is a topic for you when you gather together later today, when you gather at lunch or gather at dinner, right? Where are you seeing the beautiful appropriateness of what God is doing right now? It would be good for you to consider that and see that, just as Solomon sees it, looking out in the world. But let's conclude the observations, right? Let's get into what does Solomon tell us to do. He gives us advice. He gives us not just advice, but direction. And so it's worth our time to consider what that would be. Let's move into that. So the first thing he does in verse 9 through 10 is he asks a question that he's been asking. And the question is, verse 9, like, what gain has the worker from his toil? He's going, I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Now, we'll go ahead and read verses 11 through 13 here as well. He says, he has made everything beautiful in its time, and also he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to end. And I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and do good as long as they live, and also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of his toil. This is God's gift to man. And so he returns back to the question, is there any worth in doing things? At this point, based on the observations of what he's seen, is there any point in doing anything? And the answer that he gives us is yes, but I want just briefly to define this idea of toil, right? This isn't just like go work out in the garden, go grab your briefcase. This is human effort exerted across all areas of life. This is going in doing something, even if that something isn't revenue generating or isn't even going to be noticed by other people. He's going, is there any point in doing anything? Based on what he's seen, is there a point? And the answer is yes. Verse 13, he's going, it's actually a gift and something that you can rejoice in. There's some worth in it. And it's qualified by everything he said in chapter 2, certainly. But looking at verse 13, he said, everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. It's God's gift to man. There's something objectively enjoyable about doing things. And at this point, you might be like, this is not the sermon I wanted to hear this morning. Right? Like, you're like, I didn't want to hear, go get back to work. But that's the idea here. But I think if we take a moment and we sidestep our joke there, we would realize, Last time you did something, right? Let's think about the last time you did something, whether it was cleaning out a closet, helping a friend with something, finishing up a work project. Assuming it went well, at the end of that, you probably were like, oh, I did something. Huh. Yeah. There's some pleasure to be found there. And I think that is exactly what Solomon's getting at. He's not saying this pleasure is going to satisfy you and somehow make you fully content, but he's going like, hey, there's actually something there that's enjoyable. There's something that can be found, and he qualifies all this, right? We skipped over verse 11 and 12. There's some caveats here, certainly. But he's going, hey, there's actually something to be enjoyed and rejoiced in working, in an effort, and toil. So let's look at those qualifications. Verses 11 and 12 are certainly important notes, and we would be very wrong to just purely skip over them, but I think helpful to see where he's going first. So, looking at 11, verse 11 contains a warning of what not to do when you're rejoicing in the gift of toiling. So let's look at verse 11 again. He says he's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And so we have here a rather tricky verse. Let's just say it for what it is. It's a little unclear on what exactly is being said. It's unclear specifically as we're thinking about the idea of what does it mean to have eternity in our heart? It's tricky. Let's just admit that. I think after, kind of considering this, doing some study on it, the place where I landed is it's the idea that we have this longing within us. We are eternal beings. It's certainly evidenced in other parts of Scripture. We are eternal beings, and we have this longing to understand things from an eternal perspective. Like, we want to know what's going on. And I think just experientially, you would agree, that's part of life. That's why we write history books. That's why we're training computers to try to understand the big picture. We long to see, like, what is the overarching picture? But verse 11 paints a problem for us that we experience as well, right? You have that longing in your heart, yet you can't find out what God has done from the beginning to end. One author put it well, and I think this will be helpful for you. It's as if we want to stand back and see the scope of eternity. We want to stand back. The trouble is we're standing right here, and this is all we see. We're wanting to see the whole thing. And yet what we get instead is we get this movement of this little window where we're like, oh, I think I see a pattern. I think I see something changing. I think I see something moving. And if you're seeing it, the answer is yes, you are. But can you stand back and see the whole thing? The answer right now is no. And it's that tension of you want to understand the eternal, but to the point of the warning here, to rejoice, you don't actually need to understand the whole picture. You want to, but you don't necessarily need to. And that's tough for anyone to hear. Is that not right? How many times have you said, someday I'll understand? And then it's been a few days. I heard some laugh, just evidence, right? Like, it's the reality. Like, sometimes we don't get that explanation, but sometimes we do, right? Sometimes we can stand back and say, I see what God did there. And it's that tension. And I said at verse 1, I would come back to this idea. And so I'm going to do it, right? If you're like, I don't see the pattern, the reality is the window you're looking through is too small. And so sometimes you're like, oh, I see it. And the reality is, yeah, you see it. But you can't get back far enough to see all of it. And so there's this tension of, like, I'm observing, just like verses 2 through 8, there's these patterns, there's these flows. And yet sometimes you're like, I just can't sense it at all. And so Solomon paints an accurate picture of what it is to live between those two tensions. We get a glimpse of it certainly sometimes, but at certain times it's just hard to see. And the reality is, like, we think this knowledge is essential to us continuing in work and toil and enjoying it, but it isn't. Right? That's the tough part. There's no way around it. I can't give it to you any other way. and I have to wrestle with it just as you do. But it is possible to find great satisfaction in other things he hasn't gotten to yet. So if you're like, whoa, you just like dump some major rain on me, and I'm kind of feeling like, what's the point? Get there in a minute. He does give us something, though. It's not all just doom and gloom. He says you can, verse 12 to 13, you can actually enjoy, looking back at the verses, perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and do good as long as they live, and that also everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. It's God's gift to man. So he's going, hey, there is something to be enjoyed here. I think that's, they're attainable pleasures. They are lesser pleasures for sure, and we have to read chapter 2 and remember it to kind of understand the context of what's being said here. But I think it's helpful to see he's saying there are some pleasures in life to be enjoyed. You should go enjoy those, right? And that's encouraging, certainly. We have to keep in our mind also chapter 12 where he says, go enjoy it, but then, oh, by the way, don't forget you're going to be judged too, right? So there's always a lot of stipulations and carve-outs here as we consider this book, because it's a difficult book. But he's going, hey, there's actually something to be enjoyed in doing good and eating and drinking. There's something to be enjoyed about that, and I hope that you live a life in a way where you enjoy that. Like, that's a normal part of life, right? Like, there's something good about doing good. We're called to act. And I think this is a corrective to some of us who might just feel a sense of despair, right? Like, Ecclesiastes is often broad-brushed as this just doom and gloom book that's depressing and so terrible. But he's offering us some helpful insights on what is to be enjoyed. And he's also giving us an encouragement that action is necessary on our part. Like, it's not meaningless to go do things. It's important. Even if those things aren't, churchy things that happen on Sunday, right? Like, there's value in doing so much. There's worth in that. And so he certainly wants to remind us of that truth. God's not upset or somehow mad that you're out there enjoying something you do. He's sitting up there going, you're doing something that's not directly related to church, and I don't like it. That's not the picture of God. There's pleasures that he gave to us. Now, is that the ultimate pleasure that Solomon's searching for? No, certainly not, right? To be clear, but there's something to be enjoyed in point two, rejoicing and doing good in the gift of toil. There's worth here to be found. I think this is a helpful encouragement to us that toil and effort is a gift that God's given to us. It's a good thing. Even though it's cursed with sin and sinful people, right? Let's just acknowledge what he acknowledges. The world is broken, but even in the brokenness, there's still worth there. And so it's good to see that. Now he hasn't, to be fair, really given us anything of ultimate value here. If you read the book and understand where we're at in the text, he's certainly not offering us his final conclusions just yet. But in verses 14 through 15, he begins to preview where he's going. He begins to kind of tip his cards a little bit and be like, so here's where I'm headed. And he gives us a preview of some of his conclusions in chapter 12. And so these conclusions that he comes to at the end of the book are certainly the satisfying answer to the question of what are we supposed to do, right? And so let's continue and consider verse 14 through 15. And so just for a moment, let's look. Yeah, there you go. Let's look back at verse 14 through 15. Let's read those together. It says, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. And that which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been, and God seeks that which has been driven away. And so through these verses, verse 14, like, we see the stability and the control of God, right? He's painting the picture of, like, he sees all the things in the world, and then he's like, but I can't ignore that God seems to be above all of it. I can't ever get that out of my view. As much as I try to just look at this, seemingly, my eyes are always drawn up to God and his activity. That's one of the things that comes out of verses 14 and 15. He's going, it seems to be, again, I perceived, there's this divine action of God that's sovereign over all of the things that he sees. He can't not see that. He can't ignore it. You might say, well, is this just suddenly fatalism, right? Is this just determinism? Is God just going to do things and we can't control things? Well, no, of course not, right? We just went through verses 9 through 13 where he talked about action, human involvement, but then 14 through 15, divine sovereignty. God is over all things. And so we look at this and we begin to observe God's action. Just think for a moment, like think about things that God is going to do and did. Like he sustained and has continued the church just as he said he has. Just like he promised, people have certainly tried to thwart it, and yet the church remains. The things, verse 14, that God does, they endure forever. There's something that you, as you look for patterns, you can't not see the pattern of God's control. You can't ignore that. And so, verse 15, which is a somewhat confusing and strange verse, I think one author kind of helpfully described this verse in short, so I'll just kind of borrow from that idea. It's this idea of God is, looking back at the text, like that which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been. There's this doing over of things over and over again. God's doing different things over and over again to remind you that he's present and active. He's drawing your attention. It's like, hey, did you see that? Oh, that's interesting. That looks just kind of like the... Oh, yeah, did you see that? Did you see that? And it's God going, hi, I'm here. Do you see me? Do you notice my presence? Do you observe what I'm doing? And he's drawing people that are far from him into the verse to back to him. I think that's the idea of this verse. And what is he drawing them back for? That's the question. And the answer should be rather obvious, and it's probably what you expected. It says in the middle of verse 14, God has done it so that people, what do? They fear before him. So that brings us to the third point. And see that the sovereignty of God is present, and what should you do as a result of that? You should fear him. It's the only sane response. As we begin to observe the course of time, and we start to pick up on patterns, we can't ignore the presence of God present in all of that. And the only sane response is to go, who is this? Who is this God that has done this? And to be in awe and wonder of who he is. Now, certainly, we need to take a moment and consider this word fear. Right, it is, as I mentioned, it is an important word throughout the whole book. And so it's helpful to understand that really at the conclusion of Ecclesiastes, he brings us to this word as kind of shorthand for conclusion of really the whole book. And so he's developing an idea, and here in chapter 3, it's really just begun. And so to be fair to the text, we need to understand that all of the conclusions of chapter 12 are not yet present. But as New Testament believers standing here studying the text, we can't not see some of the things that are in this word. Certainly this word is a key idea in wisdom literature. It is present in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, very famous verse, present in Psalm 33:18, Job 2:3. Like all of these books where this word and this idea is used to be something very meaningful. And certainly at the end of the Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, he says, the conclusion of the whole thing, fear God and then keep his commandments, right? That's where he's working to. But as we consider the flow of the text here, this book, chapter 3, he's starting this idea. He'll continue it in chapter 5. And the next time he picks up on the idea of fear of God, next time he picks up on the idea of fear of God is at the temple of God. Which kind of makes sense, right? Like, as we're thinking it through, we're thinking, okay, he's observing the world, the brokenness of the world, and God's divine activity, right? It's right to fear God in that situation. But the next response is to see all the brokenness and to go, okay, well, how will I approach God? And the answer comes in chapter 5, where chapter 5, he returns back to the fear of the Lord, and he talks about how the only sane way to worship God is to keep in the back of your mind the fear of God. No one in their right mind can approach him without that. And so you need to be careful as you approach the altar. The altar is the next place he goes. And so certainly he returns back to the idea in chapters 7 and 8, but we don't necessarily have time to go there, and that's not the text for the morning. But in chapter 12, he concludes the idea. Fear is really the stand-in, this summary phrase of what it is to trust in the mercy of God, to trust in his grace that's being provided for us, and then out of that, to live out a right life. And so 3,000 years later, right, we can stand looking at this text, seeing what Solomon commands us to do, to fear God, and we can understand that this is a call. This is a call to us of what will you choose to trust and find hope in? Will you find it in just the churning of time, these never really slowing down moments that are just coming at you one after the other, and will you trust yourself? Or will you look up and see God above you, see his sovereignty, see who he is, see your own brokenness in the world around you, and then like Solomon in chapter 5, will you turn and will you approach the altar, right? And the Old Testament saints approached the altar because they realized the sacrifice was necessary to stand between them and God. And so as New Testament believers, certainly we understand that that sacrifice was pointing towards Christ and the way that we might be able to receive mercy and grace from him. And so for some of us, this is just a reminder of what has happened in our life and the reality of our life. It's a good reminder. It's a helpful reminder, one we need to hear, just reminding ourselves of our place rightfully in response to who God is. We need to call that to mind. For others of us, like, this is a call to approach the Lord and to find mercy, right? God is not aloof and removed from our plight. God cares. God has sent his son. God has been gracious to us and kind and providing a way that we might approach him. And so fear before him and God's sovereignty is the starting block that gets us to a place of having right relationship with God. And so hopefully this morning you've seen some of the things that Solomon has given us, right? He's given us a beautiful observation of what it is to look out and see the world. I hope that some of that resonates with what you see and what you'll experience in the coming year, right? It's a good description. He's given us the encouragement, hey, you know what? You can enjoy going and doing things. That's not wrong, and that's good to do. You think just of the seasons of your life this past year. Some of them were probably very pleasurable. There were some moments where you're like, that was good. And God's like, yeah, that was. You should enjoy that. You should give credit to God for that. You should see God's hand in all of that. But there's many beautiful things that God's given to us, and even the hard stuff, too. And finally, we should see God's sovereign hand over everything. We shouldn't just be like, oh, that's interesting. There just seems to be some patterns. Oh, just oh, whatever. No, it's clearly the fingerprint of God that's over everything. And the only sane response is to go, who is this that has done this? Right? In the words of Job, towards the conclusion of Job, I put my hand over my mouth. I just need to stop talking. I just need to sit in wonder of who God is and fear him. He's a good God. He's far infinitely more complex and powerful than we can understand in so many moments of our life. So where can we leave from here, right? Let's just think for a moment. We may not be walking through the threshold of my door or the sign over your head, but you certainly at this point, if you've somehow not had Ecclesiastes on your mind, I don't know what happened. I feel like I didn't do a good job, but hopefully Ecclesiastes is on your mind, and rightfully so. It's good to think about the ways that we can appreciate the different moments in life. They're a gift from God. They're a good thing that we should enjoy. Is every single moment, the greatest ever? Well, the reality is sin is in the mix, and so that complicates that answer. But we can find joy in doing things, and we can find comfort in knowing that God is sovereign over all. There's not a bunch of random chaos out there. God is doing things. God is active, and he is involved. And so as we cross over the threshold into the new year, my hope is that whether in weeping or in laughing, whether in seeking or in losing, that whatever season comes at us, that we can look up to God and we can fear him and joyfully do good, because with God, everything truly does have a season. Let's pray. God, it is a privilege to approach you. It is a thing that we don't approach as a right. Thank you for your word and the time that the preacher, Solomon, the time that he spent considering your world. Thank you for the accurate picture that he gives us of what it is to be human. The pain, the sin, none of that's ignored. And yet we can't go through it all and not see you. And thank you for how he directs our thoughts to you. Throughout this book, there's these little glimpses that offer us hope in who you are. Thank you that you've revealed yourself in Christ far more clearly, and that we can see and perceive you in ways that weren't possible even in Solomon's day. Thank you for the hope that we have in your Son, that we no longer approach an altar wondering how you will make us right with you. Thank you for your Son and the sacrifice of the cross. Thank you for the unity that brings us together as we come together forgiven and washed. And for those who haven't done that, we ask that you would be working in the patterns and the seasons of life to draw them closer to you. We ask this all for your Son's name. Amen.
Amen.